to a special edition of the Hali Hewa podcast with your host, Abigail Kima. This podcast interviews powerful African climate activists and experts, inviting them to share their personal experiences as they advocate for environmental and climate justice in their unique capacities. Today, we are joined by a lovely guest, Claire Nasike, who is the project lead for SEED, its sovereign campaign at Greenpeace Africa, the third awardee of the Wangari Maathai Scholarship and the founder of the Hummingbird Foundation, an initiative that connects school children to nature by establishing organic food and botanical gardens. In her free time, she loves reading and writing articles on her eco blog, which I will link on the description box, which has been nominated twice for Kenya Bloggers Awards, which is called BAKE in 2015 and 2018. Welcome, Claire. It's lovely to have you today.
Thank you so much, Abby, for having me on the podcast today.
Great. For as long as I have known you, you're very passionate about indigenous food, seeds, and have been a food campaigner for a long time. Why is this work so important for you?
I think this work is very important for me because, you know, food is important. We all need food for sustenance. We all need for survival. And it is important for us to understand where food comes from, how it is grown, who grows this food. And that is why I'm extremely passionate about food and food systems in Africa. And my work majorly focuses on food systems in Kenya with Greenpeace Africa. And so that is something that I really love doing. I'm just, you know, understanding where does our food come from? Because most of the time, we rarely pause to ask ourselves, where does the food come from? When we can buy that food from supermarket shelves, we can buy it from the local markets. We don't really ask who grows my food. How is it grown? Is it grown?
Oh, wow. Thank you for sharing it. And I think it's very evident because of the food that you post on social media, and it's very indigenous, very traditional. Do you eat this kind of food every day?
Yes, I do. I actually eat that kind of food almost every day. You should see my meal, meal plan. I do eat a lot of indigenous foods. And the reason I do that, it's also for educational purposes. The reason I post it on my social media, rather, it's for educational purposes, because there's been a lot of negative connotations associated with indigenous foods. They've been portrayed as poor people's foods. They've been portrayed as, you know, foods that are not they're not cool enough. So for me, my work is to show people that indigenous is cool, indigenous food is healthy, indigenous food has a lot of nutrients that are necessary for our body, like to nourish our bodies. That is my job. And I believe that the more people are aware on the nutritive aspect of indigenous seeds, or indigenous food rather, then we would not be speaking about certain kind of illnesses, you know, that are a result of, you know, the lack of certain nutrients and so forth.
I completely agree with you, and I think when you live in the city, you always desire to get food that you only get when you travel home, you know, back home to your parents. So it's really good and great that you're, you know, showing this on your social media, because I think everyone desires to have that kind of food, but it's just not readily available here in the city sometimes. And a couple of weeks ago, the government of Kenya lifted the ban on GMO, and now there are mixed emotions around these issues. What was this like for you when that was announced?
I think it was devastating for me. Having studied food systems, my master's was on agroecosystems and environment. So having studied food systems and understood some of the impacts that GMOs are likely to have on the environment, it was devastating for me. The fact that our government introduced GMOs or lifted the ban on GMOs into our country without having carried out the proper risk assessment on the impact of GMOs on human health and the impact of GMOs on the environment. And this is despite Kenya having the National Biosafety Authority, which is the body that is mandated by under the Cartagena Protocol to make sure that whatever GM crops or crop varieties that are introduced in a country, there has been proper risk assessment done and this information is available to the public. You know, that was not done. So for me, it was devastating to see that our country was actually making such a major move, and there's been no scientific evidence based on the risks associated with GMOs. There's also been very minimal public participation on the risks associated with GMOs, like do Kenyans want to eat GM food, have consulted. I think for me, that was the major devastating issue. And then of course, there was also the issue of contamination with the environment, you know. So GM seeds contaminating the environment. I think what has the government done to ensure that going to protect, you know, the Kenyan environment, or to protect Kenyan crops, like the local crops, from being contaminated by some of these GM crops. I think, so for me, generally, it was a devastating statement to read from the president, and I had really hoped that more research and scientific research would have been done before the ban on GMOs was left.
Yeah, and I think you've raised quite an important point, which is the aspect of research, the aspect of public participation. Do we actually know what we are eating? Are we aware of the risk that comes with, you know, consuming GMOs, as you put it across? So I think that's a very important point. And again, a lot of people tend to confuse the GMOs and hybrid seeds. So kindly help, you know, clarify this for the audience.
Thank you for that question, Abby. I think there's a lot of confusion now, now that Kenya has, you know, allowed GMOs. A lot of people think that hybrids are GMOs and vice versa, but GMOs are not hybrids and hybrids are not GMOs. There's a distinct difference between the two. I'll start with hybrids. So basically hybrids, they are a species of two crops that are from the same species. I'll give an example with maize. So probably we have a maize variety that is high yielding, and we have another maize variety that is drought resistant. Mm-hmm. And as a farmer or as a plant breeder, I want to have one maize variety with the two characteristics, one that is high yielding and one that is drought resistant. So I'm going to breed the two maize varieties together. I get the required variety that I want, which is a maize variety that is high yielding and drought resistant. So for GMO, it is the completely opposite. So GMOs, these are genetically modified organisms. They could either be plants or animals. So GMOs, how they are created is that the DNA of I'll give an example again, DNA of a plant, for instance, maize, is altered. And when this DNA is altered, there's the introduction of a DNA of a different species completely. So we could be bringing together two DNAs of, let's say, a soil bacteria and a plant. So these are completely different species that would not come together in natural conditions. They would not pollinate. They will not mix in natural conditions. So, for example, again, BT maize. BT maize is a variety of GM maize. So BT maize is made by taking the maize species, the DNA of the maize species, you mix it with the DNA of a soil bacterium. BT Bacillus thuringiensis is a soil bacterium. So those two are mixed together in a laboratory, then they form BT maize. That is what GMOs are. So GMOs, you're mixing the DNA of two different species. They are not in the same class whatsoever. So maize and soil, or maize and something else. And then for hybrids, similar species, maize and maize, tea and tea, or, you know, coffee and coffee, something of that sort. So that is the distinct difference between GMOs.
Yeah. Well, thank you for clarifying that. I'm also getting educated. And are there tangible impacts of the GM seeds, as you've put it, that you have seen, which Kenyans or Africans are not quite aware of?
Yeah, there are a lot of environmental concerns. I won't call them impacts really, but there are a lot of concerns with the use of GM. So this could be GM crops or GM seeds. And I'll start with GM seeds. Seeds eventually give rise to GM crops, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So there's the issue of cross-contamination. Cross-contamination, I mean the contamination of non-GM crops or local crops. So for mm-hmm. instance, we have a farmer growing GM crops and the next farmer growing non-GM crops. Mm-hmm. There's the risk of cross-pollination. You know, we can't control cross-pollination. Wind, bees, you know, they do the pollination. That is natural. So we can't control that. So there's mm-hmm. the risk of cross-pollination between the GM crops and the non-GM crops. When that happens, you find that an individual who had no intentions of growing GM crops finds themselves with GM crops on their land or on their farm. Then that brings in the issue of patents. By patent, I mean GM seeds are owned. It's a technology. Remember, we've said it's a technology that is done in the laboratory to mm-hmm. make the DNAs, you know. So mm-hmm. it's a technology that is owned. And it's owned by certain companies. So it's patented, it's owned, this is their technology. So as a farmer or as an individual, if you're found growing a GM crop without having purchased the seeds from the rightful suppliers, then you are likely to be, you know, imprisoned, you're likely to be fined because you're growing their technology, you're growing their seed and you haven't paid for it, something which we call royalties. So that is one of my concerns with the use of GMOs. And when that happens, you'll find that we're going to have a lot of loss of local species, loss of indigenous species, because now everything is being contaminated by the GM crops. Then we're going to lose species. And that speaks to the loss of biodiversity, which is a key concern, particularly when it comes in the food space. And then the other issue is also on livelihoods, loss of livelihoods. I'll speak with the example of farmers in mind. So farmers produce certain kinds of food in Kenya. Speaking of maize, in Kenya, we produce about 40 to 45 million bags of maize, right? This is what farmers in Kenya produce, you know, from the Eldoret regions, Trans Nzoia, all those regions in Kenya that produce maize and sell to the National Cereals and Produce Board. You know, mm-hmm. so that's those farmers that produce that maize, if we allow, let's say, the importation of GM maize grains that have been grown elsewhere, what we are doing is that we're killing livelihoods. Because remember, farmers grow food to earn a living. The same way you and I go to work to earn a living, farmers go to the farm to earn a living. So now when we import maize that is GMO, that has been grown elsewhere, and yet we have farmers in Kenya who grow maize, then we are killing their livelihood. And that mm-hmm. is a socioeconomic concern, because now if people cannot feed to grow themselves, we've become slaves. We are depending on other countries to actually grow food and feed us. The other concern that I have with GMOs is the issue of seed control. Remember, we've said GMOs are patented, they are owned by people. And so the supply of these seeds is also regulated by certain companies. For example, we have BT maize, we have BT cotton. All these are GM varieties, yeah? So mm-hmm. the seed has to be supplied from their regulated or registered supplier. So in the event that we have a shortage of this seed, then farmers are not able to produce. And that speaks of seed control. I have grown up with my grandma. I used to see my grandma store seeds, you know, in the kitchen. I don't know how many mm-hmm. of your viewers know that. But mm-hmm. for those who've grown up on the farm, they will definitely know. I grew up on the farm, so I definitely know. My grandma used to keep seeds in the kitchen. And every planting season, she would get her seeds and go and plant. So she didn't depend on anybody for the seed. So now we have a situation where, for example, we have these companies like that are controlling the supply of BT maize, controlling that supply to the farmers. So what happens when it's the planting season and farmers do not have seed? What that means is that then consumers will not be able to have food. And if consumers don't have food, hunger. that trickles down. So the issue of seed control is a major issue when it comes to GMOs and the control of food, because seed always has to be with the farmers. If seed is not with the farmers, then that is a problem, because farmers know when to plant, they know what time is best for them to plant, and so they must have seeds at all times. And we have seen examples of BT cotton, for example, in Kenya, where it was introduced, and farmers embraced it real quick because, you know, they are going to make money from it. But now what has happened is there's a shortage of supply of the BT cotton seed. This is after farmers have actually embraced the planting of BT cotton. So now the government is saying they're going to introduce BT maize. Maize is a key crop in Kenya. Every time we talk of food insecurity, what do we refer to? Shortage of maize. Every time there's high unga prices, what do we refer to? Shortage of maize, right?
Yeah.
So now we want to introduce BT maize, have farmers grow BT maize, but someone else controls the seed. What are we doing? Are we not enslaving our farmers? Are we not putting ourselves as Kenyans at risk of food insecurity? I think those are the three major concerns that I particularly have with the lifting of the ban of GMOs in Kenya. And those are things that people are not quite understanding why we're raising that up. I've tried raising that up in my personal capacity, and people are still not understanding. You know, it's always seen as fighting biotechnology, but ideally it isn't fighting biotechnology. It is asking the relevant questions, and particularly the question patents. Our farmers will begin being arrested. And Abby, I can tell you for a fact that we've had cases of farmers being arrested across the world, you know, for using the BT or the GM seeds, because, you know, the GM seeds, it's a patent. You can't regrow it. You can't replant it.
Mm-hmm.
For you to replant it, you have to go and buy a fresh seed. So the farmers, some of them, they've been losing court cases. Like in Brazil, farmers sued some of these producers of the BT, maize, BT soy, you know, BT cotton, and the GM seed producers. They actually sued them because farmers wanted to replant the seeds. But the GM maize producers were saying, you know what, this is our technology, this is our seed, so you can't replant it. We make the decisions on what you can do with it. We've seen farmers in India, you know, where GM variety grows on your farm, but you didn't intend for it to grow on your farm. You know, nature happens, cross-pollination happens, something that is beyond our control. It happens, you find yourself with a variety of BT maize on your farm. You know, you're arrested, you're taken to court. Like farmers in India are being tried for, they had been asked to pay 15 million Kenya shillings because a GM potato variety grew on their farm. Without their knowledge, their neighbor had planted it without their knowledge. So is that the same case we want to put Kenyan farmers in?
I am actually struck by everything you said. One, farmers are the ones suffering at the end of the day. And then two, we risk locking ourselves further into food security issues. And we are already grappling with drought caused by climate change. So I'm imagining what will actually happen when it gets to a point where farmers can't plant because they don't have seeds. And we are already suffering great impacts of climate change that is impacting highly on food security in the country. So I am really struck by everything you shared. And I think it's very important for Kenyans to, you know, hear and understand that, you know, it's not fighting biotechnology really, but really trying to ask the right questions as you've put it across. And then speaking of food and seed sovereignty, and I know, terms have shifted from food security to now food sovereignty. So how would you define the food and seed sovereignty, especially from an African perspective, being that most African countries, you know, are dependent on rain-fed agriculture? So how would you define that?
That's a very interesting question to ask. I think whenever we talk of food insecurity, everyone is like, oh, the unavailability of food. But yes, then we have new term on the block that is food and seed sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So to start, I'll begin with food sovereignty. So food sovereignty, in very simple terms, it means the ability of people to choose the kind of food they want to have, the kind of food they want to consume, the ability of a country, for example, Kenya, to choose the kind of food they would like to grow. this is food that is locally relevant for. So nobody has to dictate that you, Abby, I want you to eat fries every day. No, you say, no, that's not locally relevant for me. So by locally relevant, I mean something that can actually grow in Kenya without much effort. Something that Kenyans identify as food. Food that is available and locally relevant for us. That is food and seed sovereignty, food sovereignty rather. And that also means that we can grow this food in the ways we deem appropriate as per our culture, as per our traditions, as per our country. So essentially that is food and food sovereignty. Seed sovereignty is the ability of the farmers to breed, save, share, and exchange their own indigenous seeds, which has been an old age practice that farmers have, you know, practiced over time, and it's still being practiced still now. So I hope that is clear.
Oh yes, it's very clear. And I have heard you talk about the Seed and Plant Varieties Act 53. I hope I'm getting that right. That was enacted in 2012, but has taken farmers so long to challenge it. And then, so kindly share with the audience in simple terms what this law is about and why farmers should be concerned and how it's affecting them right now.
Okay, in regards to the Seed and Plant Varieties Act, CAPA 326, I think this law was enacted long before you and I were born.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it is pretty old. It was enacted, I think, first in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were nowhere near.
Yeah, we were definitely not born.
Yeah. So it was enacted then, and this Seed and Plant Varieties Act was meant to sort of formalize the seed sector, so to make sure that the seed sector is regulated, it is formalized. By formalized, I mean, you know, there's registration, there's certification, all that. Farmers have to be registered. If you want to sell seeds, you have to be registered as a seed market. And the problem is that when this kind of law was passed, this law was first passed in 1975, and then later on, you know, it was sections of it were amended in 2012. Mm-hmm. And when they were amended, you know, these are things that are never in the public limelight. We only come to hear about them once they have happened. Mm-hmm. So this Seed and Plant Act, what it does is that it infringes on the right of the Kenyan farmer to share, to sell and exchange seeds. So it actually makes it illegal for a farmer to sell, exchange, or share seeds, those three things. So it's not legal. And then it also makes it illegal for a farmer to sell seeds if they are not registered as a seed merchant. A seed merchant ideally means that you have to be registered as a seed seller for you to be able to sell seeds. Now, think about it. In the rural areas where most of us have homes, right?
Yeah.
Our parents probably grow food, yeah? And they share seeds with each other. So we have farmers in Kenya who are not aware that that is illegal, but they're still doing that. And the funny bit is that this law has a provision. It was amended in 2012 to add a provision to it. This is subsection 10, part 4 of it. It says that a farmer has to pay a fine of 1 million Kenya shillings or be jailed for 2 years or both.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're found exchanging seeds, selling seeds, or, selling those seeds and you're not registered as a seed merchant, then you're arrested. How many farmers are aware of this law? And this is a law that was passed by our parliament, because, you know, laws are passed at parliamentary level, and then, you know, it's taken to the president to assent to it, and then it officially becomes a law. When it starts, it's normally a bill. So this bill is passed the parliament and then all that. And finally, when the president appends his signature, now it becomes a law. So we have this law in that farmers are not aware. All right, so Greenpeace has been doing a lot of work in regards to awareness on this seed law to farmers across the country. Like, we wanted to find out, you know, how many farmers are aware about the existence of this law. And to our surprise, we found that a lot of farmers are not aware about this law. Mm-hmm. The Greenpeace partnered with another organization, Seed Savers Network, sort of create that awareness on that law. And majority of the farmers say, you know, we're not aware that this law exists. We're actually surprised. And they're saying that this is a practice that they've been doing since time immemorial. They've been taking part in it since time immemorial. So how is it suddenly illegal? You know, some of them were saying, you know, they were taught by their great-great-grandparents about this. And, you know, majority of the old, like 70s, 80s, 60s. And they're like, how is this suddenly illegal? This is a practice that we have been doing for ages. And I remember, like, in Ukambani, one of the farmers said, like, she was very old. She must have been 85 or 90. She actually told her that when a young girl gets married, they used to give them seeds in a gourd. You know, like they would put millet in a gourd and then they give the young bride. And you know what that symbolizes? Thing of new life. So that's culture for them. It's tradition for them. And I totally understand where these communities are coming from, because our constitution also recognizes that indigenous seeds are part of our culture and they should be used by the people of Kenya for their own good and betterment. So when we have such kind of a law that makes it illegal for farmers to, you know, use seeds, then you wonder, who is it benefiting? Who is it working for? Because when you also look back at the statistics of the farmers that use indigenous seeds, you'll find that about more than 78% of the seeds used in Kenya come from farmer-managed seed systems. Those are seeds that have been shared, exchanged between farmers. And now we have a law that makes it illegal for them to use the seeds. Who is that law supporting? And then there's the advent of the GMOs, you know, connect the dots. So who is making profits?
Yeah, and as you said, you've grown up in a farm, and I have grown up in a farm too. And when you talked about it, you took me back to not even my grandparents' home, but my own home, where my mom would store seeds. After a planting season is done, you'd find seeds somewhere arranged in the store. So, I didn't even know about this law, and I'm sure so many of us actually don't know, because, you know, like you said, it's culture. We share seeds, we exchange. And I don't even think anyone used to sell seeds. It was a matter of, hey, do you have made seeds? I need some for my farm. And that's how we've grown up doing our stuff. So that's quite interesting to hear. And to biodiversity and indigenous seeds, Kenya is a country that is largely dependent on rain-fed agriculture. But the understanding of some of these critical issues and information is not widespread. As you've said, a lot of these farmers are not aware of the laws, and I'm sure are not aware of the many implications that come with, you know, the laws that you've put across. So kindly share with our audience who are not probably familiar with this, what are these indigenous seeds that we're talking about, and what is the link between indigenous seeds and agricultural biodiversity?
Okay. So indigenous seeds, the link between them and agricultural biodiversity is that, first of all, indigenous seeds, these are seeds that are specific to an area. These are seeds whose origin is a particular region. So you'd find that seeds such as millet, seeds such as sorghum, their origin is in Africa.
Yeah.
So those seeds are indigenous seeds to Africa because they originated from Africa. You'll find seeds such as maize is indigenous to Mexico, so maize is an indigenous seed to Mexico. Whereas it is planted here, it has been localized, but it's not an indigenous seed here. So that is what I mean by indigenous seeds. Those are seeds that are local, that have been, you know, they're only specific to a certain region. So when it comes to biodiversity, indigenous seeds are key biodiversity because they produce many crops, many different varieties of crops. So you'll find you have cowpeas, you have pumpkins, you have amaranth. All those are local crops. You have amaranth, you probably have managu, you know, you have spider plant, which is called saga, you have millet, you have sorghum, all those kind of things. And those are indigenous seeds that actually give rise to indigenous crops. So when it comes to biodiversity, indigenous seeds encompass different forms of biodiversity. They actually have a variety. They produce a variety of different crops. which are essential in agriculture. Why are they essential in agriculture? Because they have different nutritive capacities. They have different abilities. For example, you'll find that beans can be able to add nitrogen to the soil. You'll find that sorghum has probably higher amount of iron than other crops, you know, that kind of thing. So indigenous seeds contribute to the overall biodiversity, particularly within the agricultural setting. And this is important because I think there was a report that was done a lot of years ago by the UN that said, you know, about 75% of agricultural biodiversity has been lost. And what that means is that we are planting monocultures. We are planting a lot of maize. We are planting wheat. We are planting rice. And we are forgetting about crops such as millet. We are forgetting about crops such as sorghum, which are very important crops when we start talking about biodiversity and climate change.
Yeah.
Sorghum, for example, is a very good drought-resistant crop. So if you're speaking of, you know, farmers adapting to the climate crisis, then shouldn't we be speaking of, you know, having farmers grow more of sorghum, more of millet, and then creating awareness amongst consumers that we should be able to consume some of these crops so that farmers can be able to continue growing them because they're helping us to have food even with scarce water resources, even with the extreme weather events happening. You know, those are some of the conversations that we should be having around indigenous because they play a critical role when it comes to adapting, helping farmers adapt to the climate crisis. And not just farmers alone, also making sure that we as consumers still have access to food that is of nutritive quality despite there being the climate crisis.
Yeah. You've already pretty much answered what I was going to ask you next. And you really put out across how, you know, indigenous seeds can actually help farmers adapt to the impacts of climate change. And then we move to what seed banks.
Sorry? Community. You were saying something about farming communities that you visited.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yeah. In August, I went to this community of farmers and they're mostly women in the western part of Kenya. That was Busia and Bungoma County. And an organization has really made effort to train these women, especially when it comes to the issues of climate crisis. So educating them and then also equipping them with skills of non-machinery technology to adapt to the impacts of climate change. And I think one of the most important, one of the crops that they talked about with such excitement was millet and sorghum, which they grow a lot now, and they say it does well because, like you said, it's actually drought resistant. And I mean, personally, I have so much hope in community, being that all the food that we grow in the country, we actually get from rural areas, but it's strange that we are not, you know, giving them enough support or enough education to help them, you know, adapt to the impacts of climate change. So maybe this conversation should actually be taken to communities, and you'll be surprised just how much you can learn from them because of the knowledge that they have that has been passed down from their grandparents to themselves and now their children.
Yeah, that's very correct. To be honest, I've been talking to farmers for the last, I think, 8 years of my life. And majority of the knowledge I have, I got that from the farmers. I actually learned from them. So that speaks of the importance of traditional knowledge. So when we address the climate crisis, we also need to look at traditional knowledge. How important is it in helping us at some of the challenges that we are experiencing as a result of the climate crisis? Because majority of these communities, they have a lot of information. Like you just found out about millet and sorghum. You know, millet requires very little water to grow as compared to maize.
I just sat down there thinking, wow, you guys are so knowledgeable. And, you know, we always think that you actually know nothing. But it was just like a very interesting experience for me and a learning experience for me as well, just sitting with those women and seeing how they're improving their lives despite, you know, being affected by the climate crisis. And I hear people talking about seed banks, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who does not know what seed banks are. So what are seed banks, and how and why are seed banks of great importance in preserving biodiversity?
Okay, so seed banks, wow, what a question. After we've just spoken about millet and sorghum. So seed banks are places of storage, particularly to preserve genetic diversity. So seed banks could be at the national level. Seed banks could be at the community level. Seed banks could be at a personal level. So the major essence of seed banks is to preserve genetic diversity. That means that if I, as an individual, I'm looking for a certain species or a certain crop and I can't find it anywhere else, I should be able to go to a seed bank and find seeds and grow them. That is majorly the work of seed banks. And I'm really glad that I've seen a lot of seed banks coming up in within communities, at the personal level. You know, people are keeping their own seeds, people are sharing seeds. So that is really good, because that's how it's supposed to be. That's how we preserve knowledge. We preserve traditional knowledge. That's how we preserve genetic diversity amongst ourselves.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And we are wrapping up. We are coming to the final segment. So what would you say will be the impacts of this punitive laws that you've talked about that are obviously impacting on farmers, and most of them are not actually aware? How will these laws impact on food sovereignty that you've talked about, and what do you think should be done differently moving forward?
I think when it comes to the Seed and Plant Varieties Act, I think it's important for the government to have it amended. And I should mention that from across the country have come together and they went to court with the support of Greenpeace, and they want to have this seed law amended so that they can share and sell and exchange their indigenous seeds as are required by the constitution. Lastly, I think the impact this is going to have on food production is that it's going to limit farmers from producing food. Remember, Abby, around 80% of the food we eat in Kenya is produced by smallholder farmers.
Yeah.
And these farmers use indigenous seeds to produce food, at least about 78% of it. So if we have 80% of the food we eat from smallholder farmers coming from 78% of the seeds used, and then we have a law that is limiting farmers from using the indigenous seeds, the answer is hunger, food scarcity. Yeah. Farmers won't be able to produce because the prices of hybrid seeds are so high, farmers are not able to produce. And so we want people to come together and support these farmers to make sure that these farmers are able to continue growing food. They're able to keep feeding us as Kenyans. We don't need to rely on imports. We have our own farmers. Let us buy food from the farmers and let us encourage them to produce so that we also have food that is of nutritive quality, of good nutritive quality, and food that is safe for us to consume. I think I'll stop there for now. I could go on and on and on. This is something that I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, I can tell. I can tell. And this is not the only conversation we'll have. And I really appreciate you coming on. There's so much that I've learned from you and everything that you've talked about. And yeah, I look forward to doing this again. Maybe in future we'll have to talk in depth about other issues that may come up along the way. But thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us. And yeah, I look forward to doing this with you again.
Thank you so much, Abby, for hosting me. I've really had fun doing this podcast. Thank you.